Well, hello, dear reader, and hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 10 of the Handsome Timothy Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show. It is an awesome podcast that you can find on iTunes. And we're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift, which is a series of podcasts that attempt to find the culture in pop culture. Check out the www.chronicrift.com. That first www was a bit of a typo. I want to thank everybody for listening and sharing and retweeting the pretty fantastic interview last week with Dr. Arnold T. Blumberg. I know I learned a lot about zombies and mythology and things like that and got a ton of really great feedback, so please keep sharing and retweeting. We're definitely going to have the good doctor back on sometime next year, and going to have a lot more Doctor Who-themed podcasts coming up since the show is as hot as a pistol. But I have a really special guest this week, and she's been doing stand-up comedy here in the greater Los Angeles area for about the past 4 years. So she's in her senior year, I guess you could say, of stand-up comedy. She also is a seasoned field producer in the world of reality television. Also a very funny lady, but got a chance to work with, unfortunately, we're losing maybe a few too many icons this year, but my guest this week, Talia Harari, had the good fortune of working with Joan Rivers, and I figured, boy, this would be a great time to have her on. We could share some memories about this, quite frankly, American institution, and just the world of comedy, women in comedy, and how Joan Rivers affected that. So, welcome to the Handsome Timothy Express, Talia Harari.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Outstanding. So, I don't know. Let's just start with, I guess, when you and Joan Rivers worked together, and what was that experience like?
So about, I want to say 3 years ago, I got a chance to work on her reality show, Joan and Melissa, on WeTV. And I was just supposed to be in charge of her and Melissa, sort of like a talent coordinator / segment producer. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in charge of talent, your job is to just be all over them all the time. And so I got to spend a lot of quality time with her and got to know her really well. And then the season went to another season and I got promoted, but I was still with her all the time. And I feel like I got a really nice, I got a nice inside look on who she was by spending so much time with her. It was really cool. I would be with her in her bedroom while she was changing and she would kick everyone out. And it was just her and I in the bedroom and it was great. It was awesome.
Why do you think you had that particular rapport with her?
I don't know. I mean, what was really cool about her is once I told her I was a comic or a struggling comic or trying to be a comic, she would introduce me to everybody as a comic. She didn't say, this girl works on the show. She said, this is Talia. She's a comic. And it was awesome. And so she always asked me about my jokes and wanted to help me. And I think because I was doing comedy, it made us, it gave us a deeper connection than maybe someone else that was just in awe of her. And she really was something else. I mean, you couldn't help. She was fabulous. You know, everywhere she went, you could smell her a mile away. She had a beautiful perfume that everyone loved. She was always dressed to the nines and she just had this air about her and you wanted to be around her. And so I dug every minute I had with her.
I think it's fascinating that, and also, I mean, this like is a real compliment to her because I've seen a million things have been written about her, probably not enough since her untimely passing. And some people always say it's her brashness, and she was just so ballsy and sometimes even aggressive. But it sounds like you saw a bit of a softer, almost more generous side. And that might surprise some people to think that, I don't know, like here you are, you're a young Jewish lady comic. And she might turn around and be like, uh-uh, that's my gig. But right. It sounds like she was just the opposite. Like, oh, no, follow in my footsteps. Come on, like I'll show you the ropes, kid.
Totally. She was all about like, oh, you're going to be bigger than me someday. I'm going to be opening for you one day. That's what she used to tell me. She said, use my writers. I mean, she was the nicest woman. I mean, sure, people that don't know her and don't get to know her, all they hear is about this woman who makes fun of people. But she makes fun of rich celebrities.
Yeah.
Her take on it was, what did they give a fuck? They're going to go get in their jet plane after they're done hearing me bitch about their dress. Like, who cares? Yeah. You know, she was the nicest woman I'd ever met. She was truly a nice, anytime we went anywhere, I mean, she's a legend. You see what people are saying about her online. And it was true. Like we would go everywhere. She was always mobbed by scores of people. And if we were running late for somewhere, she would still take the time to take pictures with everybody, sign autographs, because she really cared about her fans and wanted them to like her too. I mean, she just, never turned anyone away. She really was that generous with her time.
Wow. Well, I think I also want to just clarify for a second there that some of that brashness and aggression wasn't part of her act. You know, I mean, she was unapologetic with everything she said.
Right. And but she was also very deprecating. I mean, she made fun and she, you know, the big thing about her reality show, it was reality, sure. But she cared about that things were funny and she wanted to be the butt of the joke. And that was really important to her. I mean, she wanted to push it and she was hysterical. I mean, she was she's very funny.
Well, yeah, I was going to say nobody could say that she couldn't take it.
No.
She'd dish it out and she took it. And she probably made fun of herself as much as anybody else over the course of her career.
Absolutely. I mean, she loved, like I said, she loved being the butt of the joke. That's all she wanted. And she was just funny. And everything she did, she was always on. She was always funny. The only time she was ever, I mean, when people say brash or whatever they say about her that's negative, was on her show.
Right.
Or like making fun of people, like the richest celebrities' outfits, you know? I mean, she wasn't like that. She was a very, very kind, loving woman. And anyone who knows her at all or spent any time with her would say the exact same thing.
Well, it certainly sounds like a lot of people are saying that during the services and over the past week. Now, I know you can't speak for her, so hopefully I'll phrase these questions right. But another word that was used a lot in her remembrances and tributes, whether it be famous people or just, you know, our friends on Facebook, was trailblazer. And, I mean, she really, truly was a female comedian at a time when there were not a lot of female comedians. And saying things that women just weren't supposed to say. Did you get the sense, or do you feel that she saw herself like that? And I don't mean in an arrogant way, like, I'm a trailblazer, I'm an icon. Or right. Did she just see herself as, I'm a comic who happened to make it?
I think she must have known what she did because she spoke about things. I mean, she would tell us all the time about how when she talked about abortion, nobody talked about abortion. So she knew what she did. But she would tell you that Lucille Ball or Phyllis Diller, I mean, she gave them praise too.
Hmm.
So I think she was, you know, blessed to have done what she did. But she always wanted to achieve more. She was never satisfied with, sure, she paved the way for people like Sarah Silverman and Kathy Griffin and everyone else who's crass and funny and female, but she still wasn't done. That's the saddest thing about this, not to change the topic, but, you know, there was still so much more for her, and that's why it's so sad because she was still paving the way at this age. I mean, it's incredible. We did an episode with Carol Burnett, who I should know this, but I don't know her exact age, but she seemed...
I think only the Lord and Carol Burnett know the answer to that question, Talia.
Probably. But she seemed so many years older. I mean, it was night and day compared to Joan's just personality. Not just personality, but her energy versus Carol's. And they're both hysterical women. And it was a very funny scene. And I was pinching myself the entire day being around Carol Burnett and Joan Rivers. But Joan is just still going. I mean, she was a fire. Like, she couldn't, it was insane. So I don't think she was, I think she knew what she did, but I also think she was grateful to still be doing it and wanted to keep going. And I don't know. She was great.
Well, one of the interesting things too about, I know some folks, Joan Rivers was not their cup of tea. And that's kind of fair enough. You know, everybody's got their favorites and not favorites, but I don't think anybody could say that Joan Rivers was really phoning it in. And especially because she would still get in trouble on the red carpet shows.
Yeah.
Like, she would still say stuff that was controversial and raise eyebrows. And I think if there's one word I would put on her tombstone or put into the obituary if I was writing one, it would be unapologetic.
Right.
And I think I give her a ton of credit for doing some stuff that, like, quite frankly, I don't know. I'll be honest. Like, I saw the CNN interview walk out. I don't know. I guess she had a point, but I didn't really agree with her on that one. But I do like, you know, and that's not a knock, but
right.
I do like the fact that when people were like, you should apologize for that, she's like, no, they
right.
pissed me off. I didn't like it. I'm not apologizing. They should apologize to me. You know, I'm like, hey, good for you, Joan Rivers. You're right. If you don't feel like you're wrong, don't apologize.
No, she shouldn't. And nobody should. I mean, that's the thing about comedy is you say stuff. It's funny. If someone gets offended, and she's right, go fuck yourself. Like, who cares if you get offended to a joke? That's who she was. That's how comedy is. It's supposed to give you some relief from your stressful day or whatever your life, whatever you're going through. And if you're going to get offended by something she says, it's like, it's ridiculous. But to talk about the CNN walkout, the woman just kept digging and digging and digging. So I don't really know exactly all the behind the scenes of what happened. A part of me thought she did it because the book was A Diary of a Mad Diva. So maybe she was playing into being angry about everything. But another part of it is like this woman wasn't saying anything positive to her. She was just digging at her like, you're a bitch and you're this, and like taking every opportunity to say what a lot of people think, I guess. But here's Joan taking time to talk to her about her book, and Joan's not being bitchy at all. And, you know, she was just like, this is ridiculous. Like, I'm here promoting a book and you're telling me about all these awful things, and I'm not being awful. I'm a comic. My job is to say what's on my mind and to make people laugh, you know? She was really like, that's the thing. I mean, her comedy was just as much deprecating. Like, she would just make fun of herself and Melissa, and, you know, as much as she did about Angelina Jolie. I mean, she just, I don't know. She was unapologetic. That's a good word.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. And it's weird because I feel like, and looking back on some of these things that have surfaced, you know, now that we have the whole of human entertainment at our fingertips on the internet these days, a lot of people, you know, a lot of people, when folks die, they post stuff on Twitter and Facebook and things like that. And just a huge treasure chest of Joan Rivers stuff has come out. And it's funny, I never really thought about this before she died, and maybe that's sad. Maybe I'm exposing myself as an I was never really a talk show historian, really. And I think, I don't know, maybe she should have gotten the Tonight Show.
Huh. Yeah.
You know, and that's the, it's crazy to think we have not had a female comic. We had Chelsea Handler, but we haven't had on the major networks,
right?
The, you know, Fox, ABC, NBC, that we have not had a late night.
Well, she hosted. I mean, she
guest hosted numerous times.
Which to this day no other woman has done, and was phenomenal. And then she had the Joan Rivers Show, which didn't do well, which actually led, I believe that's what led to her husband killing himself. He thought he ruined her career, and he killed himself on a weekend that he was going to visit, you know, Melissa in college, which is extremely sad, but. She really, I forgot what you were asking, but she...
If she should have gotten the Tonight Show.
She should have gotten
it. She got her own, but like you said, that's not, you know, there's a big difference between, you know, the Tonight Show and I don't want to pick on Conan, but you know what I mean? Because Conan's actually done very well on TBS, right. But there is a difference, you know?
No, there's certainly a difference.
And I think she should have gotten it.
I think she should have too. I think people just don't, I really don't remember what I was about to say, but... She should have gotten a better chance than she did. And that's why, actually, the last thing she did, so on Fashion Police, she got edited quite a bit, censored, you know. As much as she said, she still got censored. There were so many things. She wanted to say cunt probably every day and couldn't. So there were a lot of times that she got edited, and that's why she started her internet talk show. I don't know if you heard about In Bed with Joan, but she did In Bed with Joan as sort of her own – that was her – final talk show, I guess. And she got to say whatever she wanted. It was on the internet, and she did it from her bedroom, and it was hysterical. But she really should have. I mean, she was amazing, and she could have held her own.
Well, I hope that wherever she is, I hope Joan Rivers is hearing this, and I bet you she's going to be grinning from ear to ear, because you, Talia, are the first person to say the word cunt on the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Yay!
So I don't know if there's a better raising of the glass in honor of Joan Rivers.
Oh, I'll take it. She'd be so happy.
I think she would be too. That was really, boy, I don't know. Has there ever been a more endearing usage outside of the UK of that word?
Oh, hello, Australia.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, she was cool. You know, what was funny about her when I first started too, when I first met her, she asked me what kind of jokes I do. You know, when everyone first starts doing comedy, at least what I've noticed is it's easy to go blue. It's easy to tell dirty jokes. And guys would talk about masturbating and video games. And girls talk about sex and rape. And that's – she was like, I love rape jokes. And she just encouraged it. It was really sweet, actually. She's amazing.
I'll take it. better her than me. How about that?
Yeah.
Well, let's switch over for a second here, because you've been doing stand-up for the past 4 years now.
Yeah.
Obviously, how and why did you choose that path?
Well, I didn't choose it. It chose me. No.
I know that answer all too well.
No, the real answer is I kept thinking of stuff that I thought was funny, and I would write it down in my phone or something and think, one day I'll do that on stage, not really knowing if or when that day was going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And then one night my brother, who you know,
mm-hmm.
David Harari.
The Honorable Dave Harari, a future guest of the Handsome Timidity Express.
Oh,
stay tuned.
Cool. I'm before my brother? That's amazing. So he did a show at some bar in Los Feliz, and randomly outside they had an open mic. And I had nothing, you know, but I was like, let me try it. So I did a couple jokes to just friends, and it wasn't hideous. And about 2 years later, I hadn't done it for 2 years. And then I kept writing stuff, thinking, maybe I'll try it. And then there was an open mic again at Residuals in Studio City. Mm. And I did 7 minutes. And again, it wasn't hideous. And that's when I really started going, you know, every day and trying it out, and there were many hideous moments, but in the beginning, it wasn't so bad. So I think that's why people stick with it, because it's when it's really bad, you really want to quit. But yeah, that's why I started. I don't know why. I've always loved comedy, you know? I love comedy. Everyone wants to be on SNL. I really, really want to be on SNL, and I thought, let me do stand-up.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, like, listen to that process, because I think that's something, and I don't mean to say this in a way that's drawing dividing lines, but like people who don't do creative things for a living or have creative pursuits in their life, like they don't necessarily understand that creative itch.
Right.
And I like you said you were kidding, but it sounds like you weren't. Like it sounds like this path did kind of choose you, and that you were thinking of this stuff, and it just you couldn't help it. It was there.
It was there. I mean, don't get me wrong. There. As confident as I want to pretend that I am sometimes, because being on stage in front of strangers and trying to make them laugh is, you have to be confident, but I'm terrified 90% of the time. But I still do it. No one's putting a gun to my head. No one's saying you have to do stand up. You have to host this show in front of a sold out crowd. No one's begging me to do it, but there's something about it that I can't escape. I'm addicted to it. It's very addictive. You want to get on stage. You want to make them laugh, especially people you don't know. It's something, that feeling of a crowd of people I don't know laughing at something I said is insane. And that's what I keep chasing. And that's why I do it. But I mean, I've only been doing it a short amount of time. So I have a long way to go. But for now, I love it. And I don't want to stop.
No, well, 4 years is plenty, I think.
But not like, comedy. You'd be surprised. Not in comedy. It's like you get the most respect 7 years and on, and 10 years, really.
Interesting.
And I mean, I'm not going to – the reason I still work daily is because I'm in my 30s, and I want to have nice things, and comedy's not paying for those nice things. If I didn't care about that and I just wanted to be a comic, I'd be living on someone's couch and just be doing comedy every single day. But I do love it, and I hope that I get to do it forever.
Well, I don't know if you've heard this in your circles, but I've heard plenty of times that if you're in the entertainment business for 7 years, that's it. You're a lifer. 7 years seems to be a sort of magic number where a lot of people say, you know something? Fuck this. I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. And I'm still waiting for that moment. I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't know. I mean, I think 7 years, see, I interpreted your lifer to say, okay, I can finally settle into the fact that I'll be doing this. This is what I'm doing. So who knows? I enjoy doing production and I enjoy comedy. So I don't see myself doing something not in this field.
Sometimes when I talk to musicians, I always ask them, you know, how do you write music? And, you know, Megan writes sitcoms and stuff like that. And that being my significant other, dear readers and dear listeners. Sorry, ladies. And I kind of hate this question, but I don't really know how else to ask it. Is like, how does one write a joke? And it's weird. I write gags all the time in my scripts. But for me, and I don't write comedies, but I write dramas that are usually relieved a lot. I put a fair amount of comic relief in my scripts. And usually it's presented by the context. Like if I have a really strong context, I'd be like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if this, that, that happens, and oh, I should do that. But that still leaves me none the wiser, maybe, on how one goes about writing a joke. And, like, how do you know, or maybe you don't know until you get on stage, like what, could you tell us a little bit about that process?
I mean, that's a very good question. I think everyone has a different take on it. Some people write all day and then they come up with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes something I'll just say something, you know, in the room to someone and they laugh and I'm like, oh, that's funny. So I'll write it down and then I'll try to find a way to make it work into a joke. But it's really for me, I'm not the best storyteller. Some people just are like, oh, this one time I went to the gym and it's like a 10-minute long story and every 5 seconds there's a joke. For me, there's a lot of like set up and punch, as they call it. You know, you tell them a quick line and then you give them the punchline and that's the joke. I'm still in the space where I need a quick laugh. So I just try to do quick laughs to get me through. But there's lots of different things you could go by. There's rules of three. You know, you say like, oh, you give two examples of something normal and the third thing is the joke. And I mean, that's one way to do it, or the bait and switch. I mean, there's lots of different ways. I don't think at all that I'm the expert on how to write a joke. I just know what works for me. I do a lot of stuff about me and my relationship. I talk about myself on stage and I just try to make it funny because I think my mother is hysterical in her craziness and I think that I'm totally batshit sometimes and that makes people laugh.
Is it the type of thing where overthinking can sometimes stifle it? And stifle the spontaneity or creativity of it?
Yes, for really? Sure. Absolutely. And that's something that happens. Sometimes if I don't go on stage for a very long time, I'll get very nervous before a show that I think is really good. If I see a sold out crowd or something and I see the other comics on the lineup and they're all talented, I get very nervous and I start rehearsing my set. You know, I know I have, they tell you how many minutes you have before you go on. So it's, I do anywhere from 7 to 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they tell me I have 7 minutes, I know what I'm doing. If it's 15, I have to do this. And then I just try to remember all the jokes in my head because you don't want to go up there with a book with you unless it's a small show. And so there's a lot of times that I overthink my set and I get totally nervous and I go up there and you know, it's funny though, the nights when I get the most scared, I do better. When you think you're going to bomb, you end up doing really well. When you're confident and don't prepare, that's when when you don't do well. But I don't know. I sound schizophrenic, I think.
No,
sometimes overthinking can be a problem. Sometimes it helps.
I think it's weird because you just touched upon two topics that have been, as you know, as a diehard listener of the show, you've touched upon two topics that we've touched upon before, which I'm a firm believer that overthinking can kill a script. And you sometimes see it like, you know, because people come up to me at parties and ask me and like, you know, oh, Tim's a writer, he's a producer, go ask him. And they'll come up to me and basically ask me in so many words, why did that show suck? And I don't really have a good answer. It's a million different reasons. And one of them is I do see with some shows they were being too clever. They overthought something or it was way more complicated than it should have been. And I see that a lot with other aspiring writers and other writers who are in the festival circuit and trying to sell themselves where you read stuff and it's like, I've given the note to other writers, you could cut 2/3 of this script and it'll be 1,000 times better. But also the weird thing is though, it's a tricky line though, because I'm going to go back to another word, which is, you know, you shouldn't overthink it, but you can't overprepare it.
Right.
And, you know, I'm just going to do a little screenwriting thing here for a second too. I think a lot of us tend to rush to the script software, not realizing that the script software is in many ways a very late step in the process of writing a script. There's research, there's inspiration, there's notes, there's treatment, there's character bios, there's character development, there's character arcs. All those things kind of have to be worked out before you get to the script. And I think preparation is super important, but overthinking it and being sort of creativity, I think, comes from something you can't really define. Whether it be spontaneity or like you just said, sometimes being terrified that you kind of something kicks in, almost like an athlete, and you're like, I'm so scared, I have to fucking do something, and you put on your best show just so your fears don't come true, or so. I don't know. I don't even know if that's an accurate way to describe it.
No, it is. I mean, I'll never forget, and this might sound cheesy, but I won't forget my first real show because I've never been so terrified in my entire life. stupidly, I went on Craigslist looking up comedy shows because all I had done is open mics. And this awful, awful guy does promotions for the
comics. Oh, wait, on Craigslist?
I went on Craigslist because I
No,
didn't...
you're not going to find awful people on Craigslist, are you?
Well, I didn't think I could, but I found the one among a million. But I was just looking, you know, under TV gigs when you're, whatever, stupid, and you go on Craigslist. And he posted about doing the Comedy Store, and if you get seven people to buy tickets for your show, you get to perform at the Comedy Store. Now, the Comedy Store is, like, the best place to perform in L.A., right?
Madison Square Garden.
I mean, that's what people say. That's what people say. It's one of the top three, for sure, in L.A., and it's helped, you know, they have, it's legendary, and everyone's been there and performed there, and they have a million ghost stories, and it's awesome. So here I am 2 months in thinking, oh, yeah, I could do the Comedy Store, which is a really ridiculous thing. And the fact that if I just get seven people to buy tickets, I really can do the Comedy Store is absurd. And so I invite seven, and I get 23 people to my show, which is huge. And it's just because they were like, oh, you do comedy? I got to see this. So I think it was like 200 people there or something ridiculous. I mean, it was packed house in the main room of the Comedy Store, and it was my first time doing a real show, and I had no business being there. And my heart was beating so fast, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. And the guy was about – he was like, you're next. I'm like, okay. And he goes out there to call my name, and while he's saying the words Talia Harari, and I'm thinking, how can I still get out of this right now? Because I do not – want to go out there. This is awful. There's 23 of my friends, 200 people. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. And then I was like, all right, well, the only way I talked myself down was thinking like, okay, you have 7 minutes. That's all you have. You're not going to die in 7 minutes. So I just was like, all right, I'm not going to die. Okay. And then I told the host, don't go far. I might only do 4 or 5. And then I went out there, and it was actually, unfortunately for me, one of my better sets I've ever had. So it turned out well, but that fear was not fun. But it does, it's funny what the adrenaline did in the moment. I mean, my heart was racing so fast, I almost couldn't breathe. So,
wow.
But that still happens. I still, you know, 4 years later, and I, sure, I'm not going up as much as I want to because of work, but I still have shows every now and then. And like next Saturday, plug, I have a show, and I still will get that beating heart, the racing heart that won't stop before they call my name. And I don't know. Not everyone has that. Some people are so cool and comfortable because they were born to do this. So I don't know if I wasn't or if I'm just nervous because I'm nervous. But it also drives me. So I don't hate it.
Well, I was going to say, is there ever a point where, like, are you nervous of losing that? Losing that sort of...
excitement and fear?
Yeah. They're kind of tied close together, aren't they?
They are. I mean, I hope I calm down a little because you definitely – like once I get on stage and I hear people laughing, I get so much more comfortable and I have fun. And that's the point of it. My boyfriend Sean Quinn, who's also a comic, always tells me before I go on stage, have fun. Have a good time. And that's the bottom line. It's comedy. Have fun. But I'm sitting there paranoid and beating heart. So, I don't want to lose – that nervousness, but I would like to be a little more calm.
Well, yeah, we don't want you to have a coronary before you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, like some, I mean, I'm not like terrified every time, but sometimes, you know, everyone has sort of like a pre-show routine, I think. Everyone does something before they go on stage. For me, I just need like 5 to 10 minutes where nobody's talking to me, where I could be with myself and my thoughts, and then I go on stage. And if I have that, I'm a lot more calm. So, I don't know. I hope I don't lose the excitement. I want to always want it, but you know, it'd be nice for my heart not to beat so fast quite every time.
You know, I'm trying to tie some of the creativity and stuff to screenwriting and all that,
sure,
but let's
sure.
be honest, that's a very unique experience. I don't have to deal with that sort of fear when I open up my software. I don't,
right.
You know.
You're a writer. You have a real talent. I'm just writing jokes about being a Jewish girl dating a Catholic boy.
It's totally
different. It's
a lot easier for me to write gags into a script and make my friends laugh during a football game than it is. I don't know if I could do 7 minutes at the Comedy Store, so I have to return the compliment. But I kind of want to tie it back to Joan Rivers just for a second,
sure,
with that question or with that story, because I don't know her biography. I don't know her life story. Something tells me she's got stories like that too. I think every comic has got stories like that. And do you think something like that was added to the camaraderie? And is there a camaraderie? It's a very competitive business, but I'm familiar with the fact that there seems to be a real brothers in arms type feeling, non-gender specific, with stand-up comedians.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's also people you come up with, you know, the people that you started out with that have been doing it the same amount of time as you, there's definitely a camaraderie with them. And for Joan, because she's so, you know, she's 81, for her, it's just the whole thing about women doing it too. So there was a camaraderie there. But certainly, I mean, if you haven't seen the episode of her with Louie, you got to see it. I mean, they're both in New Jersey, I think, and she's doing the big room in the casino and he's doing a shitty tiny room. And the whole scene is about, they see each other backstage and he's like, man, I'm pissed off, Joan. And she's like, why? He's like, I'm doing this shitty little room. She's like, what are you pissed off about? Next week I'll be doing that shitty little room. We're so lucky we're getting any fucking room, you know? And like, that's her whole point. And today she had a great show. Tomorrow she bombs, and she bombed up until the day she died, which is so sad to me to say that, because she wasn't done. But she told me, what's so interesting about Joan is every show she does afterwards, there's a huge line of people that want photos and pictures and autographs. And she's used to that. And she said that on the topic of bombing, she went to some Caribbean island, I want to say, or the Bahamas, and some prince invited her to a wedding or something to perform for hundreds of his friends. And he hated her. The whole show, he's sitting there with his arms crossed. And after the show, nobody wanted a picture. And she knew that. She was like, nobody wanted a picture. They hated me. And it's like, it's Joan Rivers. She probably killed, but they didn't like her. And it was just, you know, it never ended. Like, you go through so many highs and lows as a comic. You could kill tonight, and tomorrow night you bomb with the exact same jokes that killed. It's very unrewarding sometimes, but it's an addiction, and it feels good when you have good nights. It feels good when you have bad nights because you want to get better at it.
Some of the very best people I know in the business are still hungry. Even people who are very, very rich and very wealthy and very famous who are just still hungry. And I'm reminded of that listening to you talk about.
I mean, that's actually the best way to put Joan. Joan's hungry till the very end. She's 81 years old, and I couldn't yawn in front of her because she just kept moving and moving and was never – she never wanted nothing – like, she didn't want a blank page on her calendar. And you should actually – if you haven't seen her documentary, A Piece of Work, you really, really, really should. It's on Netflix.
Yeah. But
it's such a good documentary, and it really gives you an insight into her life, because the woman who did it was her best friend's daughter, and she got access no one else could. And she just wanted to work and make people laugh, and she was funny. She did an hour before the day that she went in for that throat surgery, an hour the night before of running back and forth across the stage, you know? I mean, she was hungry.
Yeah, there's something about – I think it's interesting. We're all trying to – put our fingers on the word, like you used addictive. We're talking about hungry. I almost say that creativity is like the healthiest form of obsession. Huh. You know, it is. It's like once you're bitten by it, it doesn't go away. And there is, I get not arguments, but maybe arguments or discussions with some people who sort of don't understand why. You know, like, why is Harrison Ford still making movies? Why is Vince McMahon still running the WWE? Why is Joan Rivers still doing stand-up? It sure as shit ain't about the money. There's something much more intrinsically, like, I don't know if you want to say in their DNA or in their person, or maybe something's wrong with them in their OCD or something. I don't know. But whatever it is, it's not about money and paycheck. There's no time card that they punch out on.
Right. Well, I think... No, it's for sure the hunger, but Joan always commented that, oh, to be rich. So I think she always wanted to make more money, for sure. Let's not – I love the woman. No, she was – it was definitely the addiction and making people laugh. And it would make her cry talking about how much she enjoyed making people laugh. So it was definitely about that. But she also never thought she had money, which was just bizarre to me. She lived in a palatial apartment in New York City. I mean, nobody lives the way she lives, you know? She was so grand and fabulous.
But that's the thing. All her money was spent on that palatial estate. She couldn't buy any nice things.
Yeah.
Honestly, if Joan Rivers hears this one day, I hope she appreciates it. It's all in fun.
I hope she does. I hope it's a big joke, and she comes back with a brand new hour that says, "You fuckers thought I was dead."
I know. I want to hear that you have a dream about her this week, that she came.
I had a dream already, but it was about her death, so it's not funny, and it's sad, and I just miss her. She was so cool. And just, I mean, 81, people are like, 81, if I lived that long, that's amazing. But she just wasn't done.
Yeah, she lived in 81 years. Like, she lived.
Yeah.
81 years. You did touch upon a topic that I'm nervous about bringing up, but I got to ask the hard questions here on the Handsome Timothy Express. Because you talk about Joan Rivers, she bombed and stuff like that. What is it like? Because I think that's the big fear. Or I mean, people say they're more afraid of public speaking than death. You use that to your advantage. You're apparently more afraid of death than public speaking.
Yeah, I am.
But the bad nights that a comic has, whether I don't know if you've bombed or if you've, you know, just had a night where like, ah, shit, that sucked. What is that like, and how does one kind of come back from that? Like, you mentioned before that some people have a bad night and they're like, well, fuck this, I'm out.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Everyone bombs. Everyone bombs. It happens all the time to everyone. I've bombed several times. Bombing is when you go up there and maybe you're just not feeling it, or maybe the crowd's not feeling you, or maybe they've had a shitty night of shitty comics, or maybe they're just not in the mood to laugh, or you're at a bar and they didn't know comedy was going to be there, whatever it is, you know, or you're having a bad day and you don't feel like giving it to them, or you're in a bad mood and they didn't laugh at one joke and you're like, fuck it, you're not going to laugh at the rest of the jokes, I'm just going to bomb even harder just to piss you off even more. I mean, there's so many reasons we bomb. But it sucks. You get off stage feeling shitty about yourself, and you either say, okay, I got to get up again so that I can not have my last memory be of this bombing, which is what most people do. You could beat yourself up over it, which is another thing most people do. But you can't let it make you quit. I mean, it's just a part of the game. You bomb. You bomb some, you win some, you know, you have amazing nights, you have shitty nights, that's just part of it.
Mm. So you kind of are, it's funny, like in the world of writing, you're signing up for rejection. You know, yeah. You're signing up for people hating your shit. And it sounds like in the world of stand-up, you're signing up to bomb.
It's awful. And for me, when I've bombed before, I noticed it in the beginning, it would really affect me now, 4 years later. It's not like I'm fucking 10 years in, but... You know, the point is now if I tell a joke and it doesn't land, all I can think of is either, well, fuck this crowd, let me fuck with them, or let me try to win them back and say something that'll win them back, you know? So I try to mend the situation if I can.
Yeah, that's actually brings up a good point because I don't want to get too off topic here, but like with the – well, I was going to bring up some wrestling stuff because sometimes in the world of wrestling, like – back in the day, wrestling was much more fluid and everything, and guys wouldn't always respond to would really respond to the crowd. Nowadays, sometimes in some wrestling matches, not all of them guys, but sometimes certain wrestlers get so caught up that if they go out to a match and the crowd doesn't respond, they don't change it. They just keep doing their match. Do stand-ups can't be that inflexible? Like, it sounds like you guys have to have a bit more of a, shoot, if I go out there and bomb, I got to roll with the punches. Like is that the strategy to do, or is it wise to say, oh well, I'll just keep doing my set?
I think it differs with every comic. Some people get out there and if the crowd sucks, they put their middle fingers up and walk off stage. And then other comics feel their ego is bruised and they want to stay up there and try to make them laugh. It really does. No one is forcing you to stay on stage the whole time. If you're getting paid for the gig and you're bombing, you might want to try and salvage however many minutes you have left.
Yeah.
But if you're bombing, you're bombing, and you know, some people take it and stick out their full time and some walk off. Bill Burr did an amazing show in Philly, I think, where they hated him. I think they hated everybody. And all he did was talk shit back to them until the point that he got them laughing.
Yeah.
They were yelling at him, heckling, yelling, screaming, and he got them back somehow. So I think it wasn't Philly?
No.
Yeah.
I was going to say, they boo the Easter Bunny in Philly.
Yeah.
They think Santa Claus is bullshit there. No offense, Philly, but hey, you're a tough crowd. They boo the Eagles when the Eagles are winning. You're not winning enough.
Go Pats! Am I right, Timmy D?
Well, before we talk to the Patriots, though,
We could talk about women in comedy, too.
That was actually my last topic, because we talked about how Joan Rivers was a trailblazer for that, but there's still, and Megan and I talked about it on episode two, I love Jerry Lewis. He's a legend, he's an icon. I'm going to ask you the same question. I love him. I got to see him do, Damn Yankees. In Boston, I thought it was great. He did a whole routine in the middle of it. I think he's a legend and an icon. And I listened to him say women shouldn't be funny, and I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And he's quoted it several times. He's doubled down on it. He's like, well, I just don't think women are funny or should be funny. And I'm befuddled by this. And you know, I wrote on my Ghostbusters blog because Deadline came out and said there shouldn't be women Ghostbusters.
Nerd alert! I'm kidding.
It's stunning how many female comedies we've actually had that people forget about. Things from 9 to 5 to The Golden Girls to Bridesmaids to 30 Rock with Tina Fey leading the crew there. What is the story with this perception against women in comedy? And have you run into that yourself?
I mean, the thing about women in comedy is that they're not funny.
Right. Oh, that's the problem. Okay, well, I'm glad we solved that.
That's the problem. No, come on. Fucking around. Women are fucking hysterical. The problem is that men want to sleep with us, so it takes them a long time to even process the jokes we're telling until they realize, oh, that was funny. So nobody laughs because they're looking at us the whole time. That's what I think it is. That's one part of it anyway. No, it's just I don't know why people say that. Because
I think funny women are sexy. I think that's great. You know, I think it's true. Cool. It takes the weight off my shoulders having to make jokes all night.
Well, Joan, that was another thing of Joan. She told me to always dress up on stage, wear heels, wear jewelry, because if they're not laughing, at least they'll be looking. That was her whole thing. But no, I think, I think women are very funny, and I don't know, I think men are just either, they're nervous that we're going to take over, or they don't get our intelligent humor at all. I don't know what it is, but it is tough. I mean, when I first started, I had no friends in comedy at all. I was just brand new. So I would hang out like the male comics were hanging out at clubs, trying to get noticed and meet people and learn. And I would get asked all the time, what are you doing here? Who are you here to fuck? You know? I mean, it was awful. So it's not easy to be a female comic in the beginning, but the whole notion that women aren't funny, I think is ancient, ancient.
You know something? I was just going to say, I think there's a real generational thing happening. Yeah. And there's a real generational shift that's occurring. I think Bridesmaids would have been successful in the 90s. Bridesmaids would not have been the huge mega box office hit that it was when it came out a few years ago. You know, the generational shift is happening more and more. I think a lot of it comes from, I think it's generational, but I think a lot of it is jealousy. I think a lot of it is, like, for example, I'm a straight dude. I don't know how welcome I'd be in the writer's room with Sex and the City. Even though I totally admire that show, I think that show has very, very underrated writing and is not really appreciated the way it should be. It's a fantastically written show. And I don't know if I could write for it. I think I could, quite frankly. I think I could write an episode of Sex and the City and give it a real honest try. Maybe it would have to be polished. Maybe another female writer would have to change a little bit, but I think this element is changing quickly. I've written numerous women characters. I've never been given a note that I can't write a woman. I've been given it to change certain vocabulary things, which is well within the margin of error, but I think there's a strange jealousy that's out there that's really quite ridiculous and absurd.
It is. You know? I completely agree. I think women are just as funny, if not funnier. I'll go to shows where they're like, we have to have a girl comic on the lineup. Which girl is available? And they'll just book one. And it's like, you should have way more than just one. I mean, we bring a different perspective to the whole show. I think it's maybe people feeling superior to women. I don't know what it is, but even Adam Carolla doesn't think women are funny. I mean, it's an unfortunate thing. Sure, a lot of women aren't funny, but there's a lot of men that aren't funny too. I think women should be given a better shot. I mean, we're intelligent. I think some of the top writers on The Daily Show are women. There's a lot of women writers and comedians that are killing it. But it's just funny for guys to say that women aren't funny, you know, and everyone high fives them.
I don't know Adam Carolla. Yeah. I know some people who know him and like him. I think he's doing a good thing with this catch a contractor deal, because I think contractors are you could walk a contractor could climb a ladder and wear a top hat underneath a snake. I think Adam Carolla does some really good work. Let me just put it like this. I'm not trying to knock Adam Carolla, but my response to him saying women aren't funny is I can't help it. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler have stolen every goddamn award show over the past 5-10 years. I don't remember the last time I saw Adam Carolla on an award show.
Absolutely.
And I think there's, again, that's my jealousy thing, where it's easy. It's sometimes almost a, I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe he doesn't even mean to sound like that, but that's just the first thought I have. That's my first response. Is like, are you really mad? Are you mad that they're on the show and you're not? I don't know.
Or is he listening to a bad female comic? I mean, I'm not saying all of us are funny, but
no, but
I hear men, like, I'll do shows with mostly men, and there's a lot of times where they're just not funny, or they phone it in, and it's just not. And you're a guy, and it's like, and no one's gonna go home and blog about men aren't funny, you know? I mean. You see one bad female comic, and you're like, "Man, these women suck." And it's like, we don't suck at all. Look at Joan. Look at Lily Tomlin. Look at all these women that have done so much. You know, Sarah Silverman's huge. She's not everyone's cup of tea, but she's funny.
Well, I think Sarah Silverman's hysterical. I think she's well underrated. And if you talk to – if you go to people right now of our age and maybe a little older and say, who are the funniest people that you could think of? Think of like the 10 funniest people. I guarantee Tina Fey is going to be one of them. I guarantee Amy Poehler is going to be one of them. I can't guarantee. I shouldn't say that. But I would venture to say Amy Poehler and Tina Fey are going to pop up there. Amy Poehler is becoming ubiquitous with the world of comedy and our pop culture all around. I think you're absolutely right about the one stand-up. I think that's absolutely right, because I've not heard this quote directly. I've not seen this quote directly, but I feel this is happening where, oh shit, we hired this. I brought a woman writer into the room and she was a total fucking disaster and she was absolutely terrible. And well, that's the last time I'll have a woman writer. And it's like, no, it should be the last time you have that woman writer. She was obviously not a good fit, because there may be 10 women writers whose resumes are sitting on your desk who are the exact writer you need. And unfortunately, I think that's a great point. I think we have not, that you made there, Talia, we have not eliminated the generalization yet.
No, absolutely. And there's a lot of, and just call them writers. You know, she sucks, sure. She's good, he's good, you know. And actually, there's a lot of great, there's, my favorite comics are the ones that, they defy the gender barriers. They're the ones that talk about stuff that either one could say. Like, if you ever, do you know who Leslie Jones is?
I'm familiar.
You are or no?
Yeah, I'm familiar.
So I love Leslie Jones. I think she's hysterical. And she says jokes that I think a man could say. And she does them better than a man would say. And she's so fucking funny. She got in trouble on SNL. She just got a job as a writer there. And she said some stuff about, she made a slave joke on Weekend Update. And it was a hysterical joke. And she's just really, like, she's one of my favorite, I think, female comedians, if I have to put it that way.
I also want to say, though, there's this weird thing. I think you brought up a good point there. It was like, well, let's just call them writers, not women writers. Mm-hmm. I think nowadays we kind of have to just identify it, just because the fight is on and it's a big industry topic and conversation. But I'm not trying to do all this stuff as a blue-as-blue liberal and the fact that my girlfriend is a writer and all that. It's also to do with the fact, from a purely pragmatic point of view, I like Bridesmaids. I like Orange is the New Black, even though it's not a comedy. It's all women. I love Thelma and Louise. There's a lot of quote-unquote female/women/programming that I've enjoyed greatly as a viewer.
Right.
There's great stories out there. Why do we want to cut off any sources for great stories?
And you're a straight male.
Yeah, I'm not intimidated. So
yeah,
and also straight male. Yeah, why can't they be hot and sexy and interesting and all that kind of stuff? I mean, I quite frankly think every freshman in high school should probably watch Sex and the City.
It will
change your life, fellas. There's the answers. give every guy that and Cosmo, and they will be like, oh, thank God. Why did nobody tell us? So, anyway, well, here's hoping that things keep changing and progressing in a good way. So. Speaking of bombing, though.
Yeah.
I've been dreading this part of the podcast.
Tell me.
That was a tough day yesterday. We're recording this on Monday night, you guys. The Patriots in Miami. I mean, wow.
Well, I heard that pigs started flying yesterday, so.
Well, they certainly weren't thrown by Tom Brady into the end zone, I'll tell you that.
Talk about bombing. I just bombed that joke. Yeah, it was pretty awful. I don't really know. You know what's worse than us losing to the Dolphins are all the Dolphin fans I know on Facebook taking it to Facebook like they owned it, like they deserved that win, like it was something that they knew was going to happen. Fuck them. We're the fucking Patriots. I sound like a drunk Patriot fan.
Well, keep drinking. I've heard this is the end of. I mean, hey, we went through this with Jets fans, though. Remember Mark Sanchez?
Oh my God, the Jets are so ridiculous. They take every lowlife guy that's either in prison or just out of prison or about to retire. I just heard the Jets were going to take Ray Rice. I'm not kidding.
But he's suspended indefinitely. He can't play anywhere.
I'm kidding.
But they take him. You said you were serious. I believed you.
I know. I just got on a rant. I apologize.
Well, it's funny. This is the first time in my memory that they're AFC East last place, the Patriots.
Okay, it's week one, though.
It is week one.
No one's looking at standings. I'm not looking at standings.
No, yet. It is funny, though. It reminds me of, like, whenever I see that this is the end of the Patriots. I have seen that so many times.
Wait a second. Did the Bills win yesterday?
They beat Chicago.
All right, so everyone won but us?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. You know what I'm saying? Like, can we do a do-over? Like, that's weird.
Well, there's good news and bad news. Actually, I don't think there's good news. The bad news is we couldn't stop the run, and now we're going to Minnesota to play Adrian Peterson. Our offensive line, our defensive line are completely just need to be I think a lot of talent's going to be worked out at Foxborough. I think
if Gronkowski can stay healthy, we might have a chance, but that's not going to happen.
Well, the problem – no, actually, I thought Brady connected with his receivers pretty well. Like, Shane Vereen was playing – had a great game. Kevrell Tompkins had a drop or two. Brandon LaFell could have gotten –
Tompkins is so hit or miss.
I know, but when he hits, though, he hits that, like, two-second touchdown against the Saints, so he's great in my book.
Yeah.
The problem is that Tom Brady can't throw it to anybody if he's on his back, and the offensive line was so porous.
Yeah, it didn't look good. I'm hoping that it was just a week one fluke. Because sometimes I worry that Brady's just throwing to throw just to show that he can still throw even though no one's there to catch it. And it makes me nervous. Now, I don't know Miami won. I don't know how Miami won at all. I don't even know who their quarterback is.
Ryan Tannehill. Here's the bad news. Well, this is actually good news. Miami's pretty good. Miami is no longer – this is not the 2011 Miami Dolphins. Miami's actually really good. They got no Sean Marino from the Broncos. Ryan Tannehill is a good quarterback. Mike Wallace is an excellent wide receiver. Cameron Wake is a Pro Bowl defensive lineman – or defensive tackle, I think. And the problem with me, though, is like Cameron Wake, they've taken him out of games before. They have stopped him before, and yesterday he did whatever he wanted. Here's the thing. If you think you and I respond to bombs and failures well, I believe Bill Belichick got to the offices this morning, probably around 2 a.m. as soon as the plane landed.
Yeah.
And he has been looking at that footage. And see, part of me almost wonders if he was kind of happy because he can coach off this loss and say, all right, fellas, don't believe the hype. Everybody's picked you for the Super Bowl, but look at that. You got your asses kicked. Now let's go to work.
All right. See, look.
He likes that shit. He does that shit, and he's been doing it for years, so.
Yeah, they thrive on it. We've gone – what was it? One year we lost 31-0 to the Bills and went on to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah. So
I know it can happen. It's just – it didn't look good, and I don't like the fact that every other team in the AFC East won. Granted, the Jets beat the Raiders and the Bills – but the Bills never win. The Bills always go super close overtime and lose. So the fact that they won was crazy, and this is going to hurt us divisionally.
It's a tough division. Well, see, it's interesting. If the Pats go wild card.
Yeah.
I always like it when they play three postseason games. They keep their momentum.
Wild card? That's too soon to talk wild card.
No. I'm just saying. Hold on. I'm just saying. If the AFC East turns out to be wicked, wicked tough, and we actually don't win the AFC East for the first time in forever, since the Matt Cassel season, I believe, or something. I don't know.
Oh, Matt Cassel.
Who we're playing on Sunday.
He's starting somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, actually, he did really good. They won, too. They destroyed the Rams. Well, and the Rams, who apparently we needed a cheat to beat in the Super Bowl anyway, which who we didn't.
I know.
But if it turns out to be the AFC East is wicked tough and we actually have to go wild card, that may not be such a bad thing. Sometimes the Patriots need those extra games to get punched in the mouth a little bit, to keep the momentum going, to be battle ready.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not panicking yet because 2 years ago they had just as bad, if not worse, loss against the Arizona Cardinals, who were not that good a team.
Right.
Who won four in a row to start the season, then I believe Coley tanked after that and ended up, I think, maybe 8-8, not even. Or actually, I think 6-10. So that, in my opinion, and we had Hernandez, who was playing. I know he's a murderer, and I'm glad he's off the team. But at the time, Hernandez was an excellent, excellent tight end. We had just a ton of shit on the team, and it looked like, oh, my God, these Patriots are awesome. And then they lose week two to the Cardinals.
I mean.
And we still went on to the AFC title game. So I'm not panicking, but I'm certainly not happy.
No, I'm not happy either. I'm not going to panic either. I'll be with you on the no panic train. Yeah. But it didn't look good. And hopefully, who's Miami playing next week? I don't even know. But I feel like they're my only threat in the AFCs. That's it.
They could be in the Bills. It's a shame because the first half the Patriots were excellent.
I know.
And the second half they were terrible. They just need to switch that. They could be terrible in the first half.
Well, they normally we're a second half team, you know? So it's very bizarre what happened, and I hate the fans. I hate the Miami fans more than I hate the loss to Miami. I mean, it just wasn't pretty.
Oh, just if you go back and revisit my Patriots blog, you'll see why I give the opinions of the, you know, I don't know. Everybody could root for their team, but I'm just, and again, like the Jets fans, we heard it from them during the first 2 years of Sanchez. It's a new era in the AFC East. Oh, let's just relax, everybody.
I know, I didn't hear any of that.
Oh, it was all over. I heard that all, everywhere I went. Oh, Sanchez and the Jets and Rex Ryan, it's a new era.
Patriots are so mediocre, it hurts. I can't even, come on, Jets, really? Yeah. You're lucky you're not the Bills.
But that's,
and the Bills won, too, so I can't even talk about it like that.
But hey, it's, like you said, it's week one. Belichick likes to coach off this. Fingers crossed that they'll be doing some good strategy. You know, they'll be doing some back to the drawing board, and we'll see what happens against Minnesota on Sunday.
Agreed.
Talia Harari, this has been an absolute pleasure.
My pleasure, too. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, and this was really such a nice tribute, especially because it was full of laughs, you know what I mean? I think if I dare say the dear Miss Joan Rivers would not want to hear a lot of tears and sadness. She'd want to hear laughter and jokes.
She would. And the word cunt. I've said it three times.
I love it. First time that maybe I'll call that that's what we interview called. Cunt, an interview with Talia Harari. I'm not going to call it
that. My mom would love it.
I'm not going to call it that. No. All right, so anyway, that was a great exploration of creativity and things like that in the world of stand-up and comedy. Next week, I'll be talking a lot more about writing directly with another screenwriter. So thanks for listening. If you like what you hear and like what you read, please don't be shy about sharing, retweeting, posting, Google Plusing, Pinteresting, and everything else you kids are doing. Just want to hope everybody has a great week. Thanks again for listening. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.